If you want to see examples of what we talked about on the show, check out bunchofdorks.com and click on the Cyclops.
On behalf of everyone here at Two Dimension Comics Podcast, we want to wish you all a very merry, happy, and safe holiday season. And now on to episode number 110.
Hello, I'm Don Moore, and you're listening to Two Dimension, the comic book podcast of No Direction. And sitting across from me is a man whose memories are colored by what came later.
Okay.
Mr. Al Val.
Yeah, my memory's not that great lately, too. You should have seen what happened to me earlier today. I was in the garage, and I was looking through some books. I go, yeah, I want to talk about this, and I find the two books. And then I want to talk about this pulp art book, and I'm looking for it. And I didn't realize where I grabbed these, and I put them somewhere. I'm looking for this one. I forget. So I go, okay. So I bring this one to the room, and then all of a sudden I go, well, where's the other two books? It took me like 10 minutes to find them. They were right behind in the garage, and I was like, oh my God, I'm so freaking absent-minded lately. It's not even funny, you know, but damn it, I found it, so the show goes on.
You just described me. Welcome to your 50s, kids.
Yeah. Oh, you do the same thing,
too? Yeah, and my wife always makes fun of me. Anytime I misplace something, I say, well, I'm trying to find, oh, I thought you had such a good memory. Well, you know, I don't do this when you can't find something. You know?
I know, it's so stupid. I guess it's because you're like, you know what, when it happens when you're trying to do too many things at once.
Your mind's on other things, and that's, you know.
Yeah, you're trying to find, you find what you're looking for, then all of a sudden your mind goes, hey, what about that other thing? Oh, yeah, let me find that. And then all of a sudden it's like, instead of just going like, well, let me just take this and over there. No, you put it somewhere else and you forget, and then you're like an idiot, you look around. But I found everything, so, you know, we're all good.
Yeah, well.
We're all good. We're all good talking about comic books. And we were talking about, like, National Lampoon and before and humor comics.
Which were good.
And, it's funny because we were talking about, like, National Lampoon, basically, and we were saying how, like, they were selling. You said you read an interview with some guy, and National Lampoon was selling better than Newsweek and Time in
the 70s. Well, don't quote me on that. It was Mr. Media here in San
Diego. Oh, Mr. Media. Okay.
There's a book about the National Lampoon. You know, the I don't know what the title of the book is. I'll see if I can find that podcast and listen to it. But it was one of the people behind it, and they had a book, and they interviewed him, and he was talking. And I guess something they said was that humor magazines didn't sell all that well. I
mean, except Mad.
Well, I mean, they sold, but it wasn't hitting the levels that National Lampoon was. National Lampoon was a huge magazine in the 70s.
Yeah.
And these guys got really wealthy. They could do whatever they wanted. And I know when they did Humbug, what was it, Al Jaffe and Arnold Roth and all those guys?
Humbug was Kurtzman. That was in the 60s.
Yeah, but Jaffe and Roth.
But
it didn't go on very far. How long did Humbug last?
Not long. And then he did another one called Trump.
Yeah, Trump.
One of those two magazines before was for Hefner, I think.
Yeah, and Robert Crumb was involved in one of those.
Yeah, and then he ended up doing Annie Fanny for Hefner, and that went on for 20 or 30 years.
But they were talking about, as a matter of fact, Mr. Media had Al Jaffe and Arnold Roth on the show recently.
Are they living here locally, Arnold Roth and Jaffe?
I don't think so.
Okay.
But I really enjoyed that one.
Oh, yeah.
The one thing Al Jaffe was talking about which surprised me was...
Al Jaffe's in his 90s, man.
Yeah, and I don't know when
That's
he talks.
That's amazing.
When he talks, I've never heard him speak. And
he still does those fold covers in the back.
You can't help but like him. I mean, when he talks, he's just really interesting. But they were... One thing he kept bringing up was that he didn't own any of his work from, you know, that point.
Gaines kept it all?
Well, as we always talked about, you know, Gaines had strict copyright rules. But Al Jaffe was saying he was kind of foolish. He didn't really understand what that meant. And even though Gaines sold the work and, you know, had the auction and split it between him and the creator, I'm going to say that Al Jaffe wasn't bitter about it. I guess he was just disappointed, thinking he would have done something different. And Arnold Roth was along the same lines. I'm going to say that they're both upbeat, happy men, you know, appreciate the success, but I think they're wishing they would own that work and they could do what they wanted with it. But
Man.
yeah, I'll post that one too. It's worth
Hey,
listening to.
it was a steady gig for a lot of years, you know. I
Oh
mean, it
yeah.
paid the rent for like 30 some more
Well, they
years,
had a
you
good life and
know.
good,
Sure.
you know, but
I mean, that was the deal with Gaines. He kept the artwork 'cause for reprinting purposes, I don't know.
well, Sergio Ordonez was saying that when he did reprint those books, you know, the Mad, he gave the cartoonist the cut.
Oh, when the even the paperbacks and all
Yeah.
that stuff, that's
Yeah,
cool.
he shared it with everybody. He just did what he wanted. Now, that's what publishers did. The difference was if Marvel and DC published those little trades or something of their work, cartoonists didn't get squat, you know. But,
Interesting. Now they do.
yeah, now they do. But, and Sergio Ordonez was saying in an interview that he got a cut of that, and those Mad books that all these guys did, that had nothing to do with the magazine, they got the money for it,
I
you
used to
know.
buy those again when I was a kid. I
Me
used to buy
too.
like,
And we still buy them, we see them at the
yeah,
store,
like
you
the
know.
Dave Berg ones and
Yeah.
the you know the Mad. Oh God, I can't think of the titles, but I just remember seeing them like at drugstores or whatever, and go, and if there wasn't a comic book, I'd always pick one of those up because they're
Well, and
hilarious.
they always had to spend a rack for those kind of books buying the comic books,
Yeah,
you know.
yeah, yeah. And there was all they were always in print. I always remember seeing.
Yeah, they always had the Mad, and they had the comic strip like BC or Wizard of It or, you
Ah, oh, I
know.
love those,
Me
man.
too.
I used to get the and I bought one of them recently, the Captain Klutz.
Yeah, I've
You
got
know, the
that.
Don
There's two
Martin
of
paperbacks or whatever. I
them.
remember buying those at a Zayre's back in 19 something.
I bought it, you told them.
But yeah. Those were so the artist did get reprint payment for those.
Yeah,
That's
well,
cool.
Captain Klutz was never in Mad Magazine.
I thought he
I
was.
don't think so. He
That
was.
was just that was it was Mad's maddest artist.
Yeah, it always said
Okay.
Mad, but it was a trade.
So that was on. No, I bought it as a paperback.
Yeah, so I mean, it was a little
Yeah,
paperback.
yeah, yeah. Oh, so it was on his own then. It
Yeah,
went
and
through
it was a
Mad.
story. It wasn't just a page comic
Oh,
or
I thought
two
it was
page comic.
Mad. Oh, okay. All right.
And then he did a side. He had some other ones. He had Don Martin's Forges Ahead. Some of these
Yeah.
were reprints of Mad, but some of them were new material.
Yeah, tons of them. Yeah.
You know, I think he had two Captain Klutz books, and I don't remember him ever being Mad.
You know, like towards the end, Martin left Mad and worked for Crack for a little while.
Yeah.
That was kind of weird to see his work
But what was
in.
neat was when he did that, they had a Jolly Rancher ads in the comics he drew, and also a VH1 had an opening animated spot, and it was a Don Martin cartoon.
Oh,
And
cool.
I remember a friend of mine, a Brit, he was talking about it, that Don Martin left Mad, and it's really strange to see Don Martin in animation. And he had a, I don't know if they had Jolly Rancher commercials, but they had the comic book ad spot, and he was doing other stuff. And the reason he left was ownership. He says he reached a point in his life where ownership was important, and Mad wouldn't give it to him. And then it was in Comic Journal when I saw that, and they had one of his strips, you know, in Crack Magazine. And then they said, I guess Mad Magazine said it was a step down for the artist, you know. But he had a comic magazine called Don Martin Magazine.
I
There's
never
two
saw
issues.
that.
It was a little oversized. I think it was printed in England.
Oh, I never
But it
saw
had
that.
all of the strips, you know, some were color, some black and white. And then it had, the first issue had a picture. It was a two-page spread. It was an interview. He interviewed himself. And it was in the studio. There was a picture of him with a tape machine and a microphone. And the other one, he's sitting at a drawing table talking to himself. And he basically interviewed himself on it. I don't know, it was just stuff like that. It was a pretty neat magazine.
He lived in Coconut Grove, Miami.
Are you serious?
Yeah, my friend Jim interviewed him when he was in high school. I got an interview with him. I don't know where if he kept the tape or not, but yeah, he interviewed him from the school newspaper, sure. Lived in Coconut Grove, yeah.
Is he
Don
from
Martin.
Miami?
I don't think so, but he lived there in the 70s and maybe later, I don't know.
He was somebody that I was surprised he looked the way he did. I thought he looked like one of those big chin cartoons that he always drew, and he
His
didn't.
His cartoons were gross, man.
Yeah,
People would
they're
have like
all.
hairy armpits with like, freaking bugs flying
Yeah.
off them
They
or
always had
whatever.
names like Phone Bone or
Foam Bone and
Frame
yeah.
Bean. Frame Bean and Phone Bone. That's the name my friend
Yeah.
in middle school used to
Yeah, but
call
when you're
each
a kid, that stuff like kills you, It's
other.
like, oh
Yeah.
my
Yeah.
God, this is so messed up.
Those floppy
He
feet.
definitely had a style that was made him different from everybody
Yeah.
else, I don't know where that style came from,
Yeah, it
but
was tight.
yeah. But anyway,
Yeah,
I kind of miss the humor mags. I don't see too many of them anymore,
no
I
time
mean,
for humor, dude.
yeah,
It's the
but these
time
have to
of
be real
paranoia
serious and
and paranoid.
depressing and paranoid
Yeah.
and what's up with
Sensationalized.
that, man?
Yeah, it's I don't know.
I don't know, man. It's depressing,
Not that the
but
70s were great times,
no, they were
but
better though. I mean, we had more fun. We're still having fun, but we
yeah,
had
but
more
at the
fun.
time our parents were taking the brunt of life while we just did whatever we
Yeah, we
wanted.
just did. We were a lot. We
Yeah.
watched M.T. Graves and Count Gregor,
Yeah.
which is what we still try
Yeah,
to
but
do.
now we're carrying the brunt.
Yeah, oh, we're carrying the weight. That's definitely, a long time,
These books you were looking for, you misplaced. The first one, it caught me. I want to hear
Which is
about this one.
the pulp art?
Yeah, the Mexican pulp
I
art.
thought that I'd see talked about this before, but I guess I didn't. I don't know how I found this. Saw this on Amazon.
Yeah.
I'd never even read about it, and it was relatively cheap. And I was like, oh, that's cool. I wonder if there's any like mass wrestler things in there. And there's a few, but it's like these are the covers to pulp mags from Mexico. I don't know if these are comic books or if they're just like text, but these are just incredibly lurid and they're not the artists aren't Frazetta, but they're cool in their own interesting way. You know what I mean? Maybe not as technically, but still, they catch your attention. And it's all like the B movie crap that I love. So they're definitely a lot of fun. And I bought that like 10 years ago. It was published by Feral House. You may still be able to find it on Amazon. I don't know, but they don't look like the American pulp sweat mags like
No.
from Stag and all that. They had more accomplished artists, let's just say. These guys have their own cool feel to them that I really like a lot. So.
Well, I'll tell you, when I first see these, the stuff you described in the American version, I remember they were always lurid.
Yeah, like I got that book. They're a man's world. It's a man's world. It has all of them.
Yeah, and
Yeah,
they always had a lot of cleavage and ripped dresses and
a lot
stuff
of
that.
Nazis and half-naked
Yeah,
women.
and compromising, positions and
Positions, yeah.
stuff that your parents would beat you if you came home with.
Yeah,
This
or at
stuff,
least my dad would take it away and keep it for
yeah.
himself.
But this one, and my parents never beat me, but I never brought this stuff home, so but I just want to make
Yeah.
that clear. But this stuff here, it's kind of the same subject matter, but even if there's a woman laying there that's been like scared to death or whatever, she's fully clothed. I mean,
Yeah,
there's
she's
no
not.
cleavage. But it reminds me when you went to the Midway at the fairs and stuff, carnival, and they had the freak show banners painted out. I mean, I see these guys in tropical outfits, and there's these giant ants climbing on them, or people running away from a dragon. There's something sinister to them, but it's fun. It's like, well, there is some cleavage, but it's nicely done.
It's not as like, sweaty.
Yeah, and I mean, I see syringes and, operating tables, but I don't know, it's something.
It's more like fantastic in a lot of
Yeah,
ways.
it's more fantastic instead of lurid,
Yeah. It's more like, wow, that's weird. I
Yeah.
can't see that happening as opposed to like, well, yeah, I guess. I like the colors and I like
Yeah.
the.
I do love,
Subject matter definitely is cool.
I like seeing a lot of Mexican and South American artwork, like comics and stuff, because,
Yeah, it's different.
yeah, it's different, but like, Calimán, from Mexico,
Kalima,
and our friend Maria from Colombia, when we talk about comics, she started sending comics she remembered in radio shows. A lot of jungle characters, a lot of jungle
well,
men,
yeah,
and I don't know, it's neat, because, we like Tarzan, and there was a bunch, Kazar, Sheena, but it seemed like it never went away in South America.
which is good.
Well, it's You like those, yeah, Luchador masks.
Yeah, there's luchadors in there and all sorts of mad doctors and, floating heads.
Yeah.
And it's more comic booky, maybe.
Yeah, especially like this one. Ladies in like a purple or violet.
Yeah,
It looks kind of like
yeah,
the Phantom without a mask.
yeah. It's more comic booky.
Yeah.
When we
Yeah.
after we go to break, I'll show you the other book and you'll see it's not as comic booky.
Oh, I already
It's more
know.
for dirty old guys
Yeah, the cover has a
like
guy
me.
cringing. There's a flying saucer, and there's three almost identical women in bumblebee suits flying at him.
That's cool.
That is cool.
That's the cover.
Yeah, that's the cover, and that's really, I like that. It's just fun.
I don't know how I found it, but it just caught my attention. It was probably cheap too, so
Well, listen,
it was
I
well
like
worth it.
Mexico. They're our neighbors. They have a fantastic football team in the last World Cup,
I like their
and
wrestlers.
I like their luchadors. I like some of their movies, and I like their pulp art.
Yeah,
So
this is really
my
good
hat's
stuff.
off to our brothers in Mexico.
Yeah. So what's that? What's that book you got? It says How to Be Happy. Now, Don, tell me, did
Well,
that book make you happy?
I was talking about, I bought a book called How to Be Happy by Eleanor Davis. The way I found the book was on Facebook. I like Fantagraphics books. And they were just posting these pages, these pictures, and I liked the cover. And every time they post a page, I said, well, that's kind of neat. I didn't really have any interest in buying it. I didn't know what it was, but I thought it's not really what I'd want to see. Eventually, I just kept seeing more pages, and said, you know, it is really nice. I'm gonna pick it up. I didn't know who Eleanor Davis was, and at the back cover it says, "Write a story about yourself, a story about your life. Now believe it." And in the front of the book, when you open it up, she says, "What was it? This is not actually a book about how to be happy." I've read a lot of books about how to be happy. However, if you're struggling, the following has been helpful to me. And then she's got, several books like Depressed and Anxious, workbook for overcoming depression, anxiety, stuff like that. But I started looking up Eleanor Davis. She does a lot of magazine work. I'm guessing for higher end magazines. I can't remember what they are now, but I'm guessing New Yorker and stuff like that. Very poetic, but she wrote all the stories in here. Desmond saw this. I had at work, and he thought it was a cookbook.
It does look a little like a cookbook on
Yeah,
the
it does.
cover.
She works in different ways. I'm guessing she has watercolor. Some of these are just line drawings. Some of them are just sketches.
Who's
Some of
the
them,
artist?
Eleanor Davis.
Oh, I thought she was the writer. She's the writer and the artist.
Yeah, she
Okay.
does it all.
Okay.
But it's just basically a collection of short stories. This one is just three drawings and text. Again, write a story about yourself, a story about your life, now believe it. Now write another story, same subject, a better story, more interesting, stronger characters, now believe that. And then the third drawing, it says, just keep writing, you have plenty of time. The whole book is like that, But after that, it's several pages. It says, "In our Eden," and it's a story. It looks like Adam and Eve somewhat. The guy's hunting. She has a palette of like four colors, but it's about all these people, all called Adam and all called Eve, and it's basically the guy keeps saying, "In my old life, I was so unhappy, but not anymore." And they're basically showing turmoil about people in this group, and they're saying they're leaving. And you slowly start figuring out what they were talking about and why, but the ending was not wrapped up and kind of bittersweet, but I don't know. And it goes back to just more single drawings. It reminds me of some of the prosings we used to read, on Witsend and stuff like that, where sometimes they're just exercises. The artist would have a couple of pages, and sometimes the story, sometimes the sketches, and sometimes the sketches would tell a story. And it's like they were just exercising things to themselves and, publishing them. My favorite is this next story here. It's a color story, and it's about this woman working on a farm. And they got little scooters, and they're all wearing these hooded outfits. It makes me think of India, but it's not Indian style. And then she goes in this computer, and it's all weird, like she's controlling with her hand. It's not like a screen. And they tell her somebody's sick, so she goes home. So she leaves this dome. She's on a train, and everything's extremely alien after that. She basically constructs the whole world, and basically she came from that world and is living in the dome, and she's some type of experimental commune.
Weird.
But I really enjoyed it.
You are the design and the colors are great on that book.
It's fantastic. They keep talking about Pico Taco, which you like to eat at, but it's a future society, I guess, on Earth. Has a real heavy Mexican feel to it, but it's just overpopulated, smog everywhere. Everybody's having trouble breathing. The food, I think, is all genetically, fixed. So it's bothering people really bad. It's not a healthy environment. But she lives in a dome, everything's fine. All the food in the dome is all organically grown and stuff. But it's a controlled experiment. Anyway, it goes on. It addresses things that she loved about the place, her old life, and things she didn't love about the old place. It's not really a black and white. It's different layers to it. But the whole book is this way. It's like they tell you every story and every drawing tells you a little bit about something. She has the whole world constructed, and you're just basically seeing little snippets of it, but at least.
So you have to fill in,
Yeah.
you have to interpret it or whatever.
Yeah, and the whole book is this way. She has wood spirits, like this woman's got the deer antlers. It has just, you name it, wordless strips. It just keeps going on. But you basically get to fill in the blanks of what you want to see and talk about in it. I got the book just kind of interested in it. And it's turned into one of my favorite books. In my feeling, everybody should have this in their collection. You can interpret any way you want to. I don't like it, and I never have, when some people spell out everything in the story. They try to. It, when I say this, it's a hard thing to do. I imagine if I was able to write a story, I think I would over-explain everything and try to, tell you everything you should be thinking. There's an art to some artists that they can write a story, tell you enough about it, and leave the rest open for you to see what you want to see in it. And this whole book is the same thing. I've looked Eleanor Davis up online. She's done a lot of work. I think she's done children's story books, illustrated books, a lot of magazine work. And she's a high-end artist. And it seems to me like this is just, personal projects that she was doing. It's a very personal book. But vague, but it does tell you something. And I thought I'd just read a little bit at a time, and I read the whole thing in one setting.
Wow, there's some weird crap in here. Did you read the whole thing?
Oh, yeah.
There's some weird thing about skinning a fox here or
Yeah.
whatever. Yeah,
Yeah, the skin in the fox, and there's another where it's a drawing of a guy cutting a woman's fingers off, but it's not like brutal, it's like it's metaphorical. You're basically he's trying to keep her from doing something. I don't quite remember.
I mean, the illustration's really nice and the design's really nice on it, no doubt about it.
It's a fantastic book, so I'm giving this one. I everybody's different. Everybody has different tastes, but if you bought Eleanor Davis, How to Be Happy, you won't be disappointed. It may not make you happy, but it will momentarily when you read it. I can't recommend this book enough. But
Well,
anyway.
all right, well, let's take a break then and we'll talk about more stuff.
You got it.
Sweetest memories from out of nowhere breeze across my mind's eye. Halcyon summer sky. Back to present tense, I clench my teeth against the wind and the ice. forever is put to flight. I may nod and smile, but I want to cry. And I'll be the one laughing at the funeral. I'm a random access memory kind of guy. That momentous day, the grand occasion you want me to recall, well, I can't replay at all. But what's crystal clear is sitting near you on the river one night, counting the fireflies. Ask me when it was, well, now let me see. You ask me where, don't interrogate me. I'm a random access memory, casualty. Quarrel from years ago, still rattling round my head, but I can't for the life of me remember what you just said. What was it that you just said? I can't get it through my head. Just elsewhere, momentarily, my random access memory caught me on the fly. On the fly. I'm a random access memory kind of
You can hear our most recent 20 episodes on iTunes. If you want to hear our older episodes, you can find them at our blog on bunchofdorks.com.
And that was Ed Wattell, who has a project coming out with Steve Robinson sometime in the near future.
Oh, good. Finally.
Yeah, finally. Oh, I was talking to Steve about it, and he said, I guess he was a little, not put out, but a little concerned, because he said, it's ready. And then I guess Ed had Steve Connolly read it, listen to it. Steve Connolly was from the headlights of Steve Robinson.
Right, the guitar player, right?
Yeah, and songwriter, not the singer. He runs a recording studio, and, you know, Steve's like, oh, no. He says, because I guess Ed lent it to him. Have a listen. Anything you got, let us know. But of course, he's going to have things to say, and it's going to go right back to tweaking, you know. He did say, I know they're going to be all good, but it's just, how long is this thing going to take, you know? And he said they have enough material to put out another CD right after this one.
Sure.
And I'm thinking, you know,
it's been working out for 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, and, I mean, I've heard some of the songs, Steve Flint, and they're strong. I mean, they're always strong. This was good, and I told Steve, listen, put this one out, and then put out that Geneva Wallet album that he's never putting out, please. But that's Ed Vitale, and it's his newest album, and I like it quite well.
Right on, man. So that's newer than the last one that you played, or was it the
same? It's the same.
It's the same one. Okay.
That one about algebra? I don't think you really cared for that one.
No, I thought it was okay. Yeah, I liked it enough.
To me, I like the rhythm in some music. You know, that's what I'm always listening for. And Ed Vitale, I never really, I don't know, to me, he sounds more like notes and rhythm isn't always his thing, but this album had more of that. I remember Steve had me listen to it. I said, I really like this, and this is my favorite Ed Vitale work. He said, yeah, I had a feeling you're really going to like that. He said, you like the rhythm. I have no rhythm, but I love the rhythm.
Okay.
Anyway, right, you got something else there I'd love to hear about.
Yeah, this is... I think this originally came out in the Spanish editions of Creepy back in the early 80s. This was an artist, Fernando Fernandez, and he did his adaptation of Dracula. I guess this was done in, you know, in each issue, a few pages, but I got it, yeah, it must have been like 10 years ago, 8 or 9 years ago, at Barnes & Noble, I guess, as a graphic novel. And it's just beautiful art. Check it out. I mean, this guy, Fernando Fernandez, is one of the, he was in the same studio with Morodo and all those guys. Yeah. That was one of the Spanish comic book studios that Warren, dealt with in the early 70s and produced a lot of work. And Fernandez was one of the better artists. And man, that thing's all painted, and it is spectacular art. You know, a few years after he did this, he left comics completely and just did, you know, just painting. And I can see why, because he's a strong artist. I mean, you know, definitely a beautiful. It's a good adaptation of Dracula. I always like to read, you know, adaptations of it. It's pretty faithful, and
yeah.
You know, it's got that European feel to it. You know, the people look different. You know, the women look different. And even though it was produced in the 80s, it's got a 70s vibe to it. You know?
It reminds me of Hammer horror films.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, it does have that. It has that 70s vibe to it, but from what I've read, it was done in the 80s. You know, it's interesting because the Creepy and the Eerie magazines that were published in Europe were different from the American ones. I guess they licensed the name from Jim Warren,
mm-hmm.
and they probably used a few stories, but I have a couple of issues, and they would have, like, articles on movies and different stories, and the cover stock was different on their editions. I mean, I wish I could, you know, get more. I probably could. I have relatives there, but, you know, I don't know if they could, you know, get them for me or whatever. But, yeah, I mean, and this is like an early, early graphic novel. This is from maybe, I mean, I get it. It was done in segments in comic books, but it's been repackaged as a graphic novel. But it was done in the 80s, so it's probably... pretty early on, and there's a lot of, you know, it's a lot of pages, and it's really nice, you know.
Yeah, it doesn't seem 80s to me. It does seem like from the 1970s.
It does seem 70s, but everything that I've read about it said it was done in the early 80s. But it sure seems like 70s to me, but okay,
yeah.
You know, I'm not going to argue.
Whole style and characterization, even the lettering. Like I said, the colors and the style of it makes me think of Hammer horror films.
No doubt.
The way it's put together, but Hammer horror always had a smoothness to it. This has a rough painting, kind of an abstract, which I like. One thing I love, and Bill Sienkiewicz did it, a lot of painters did it, when they painted their comics, there was no outlines. It was just like everything was cropped, and even the word balloons. There's no outlines, the word balloon is just white with the lettering on it. It's a good look that I love.
Yeah, because there's so much color in it that, you know, they don't need a... You don't need a balloon on it, you know what I mean?
Or
it's just like,
panel outlines.
Yeah, you don't need a panel outline or whatever, but yeah. Yeah, I was just going through the book, and I was like, oh, I forgot about this. Yeah, this is really nice, you know. There was a comic book put out in the 70s called Dracula, which was a Spanish book, and it was mostly Morodo and a few of the other guys, and it was an interesting book, too. Very, very psychedelic, definitely the Dracula one. I have a couple of issues of it that I picked up used. It was definitely a, you know, they were definitely into some strange stuff back then, but it does mirror the times.
This looks more like what Dracula looked like in the books, the way they described him.
Older, yeah,
yeah,
right.
He doesn't look like the Bela Lugosi.
No,
character.
No, not at all. Not at all, no.
Or
Nosferatu. It looks like, you know, he's an older guy with a, I think he's got a mustache and stuff like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, but he looks like the aristocrat that he was. Who? No, Fernando Fernandez. Wow, that's
yeah,
a comic book name. Where's he from?
Spain.
He's actually Spanish?
Spanish artists, yeah. They all came from the same studio with Moroto and a lot of these guys.
How did that come about? How did Warren find those guys?
Oh, then, well, you know...
Were they doing work in Spain before?
I don't know the whole story, but I know that... Well, you know about the whole... Well, Warren, like... Something happened to the magazine started selling bad. Like, the early days, it sold real well. And then by about 67 or 68, the market started going down. So he really couldn't afford to pay much. So he started using a lot of reprints, and he did. And then he started having, he might have a Tom Sutton story or an Eric Colon story or a Tony Alarico story, but half the book would be reprints because he just couldn't afford it, but he wanted to keep the books going. So somehow or another, he got a hold of, you know, he knew somebody overseas. And, you know, they hired the studio, and I guess they were cheap enough and obviously competent enough that they did a ton of work for them. And then as the years went on, like, you know, they started bringing in more American artists. I guess they started paying more money afterwards. But these guys came around kind of when times were a little bit leaner, maybe, you know. I mean, I know the leaner times were, like, in the late 60s. But by the time they came, it helped, and then they were cheap. It's kind of like the Filipino artists with DC. They brought them all in from a studio over there because I guess they were aware that they were making comic books there, and somebody made a connection. And it's possible one of the editors at Warren made a connection there because he had seen some European comic books, and you know, they cut a deal. That studio, some, you know, all the artists came from there, you know, Moroto, Jose Bea, Fernando Fernandez, and then there was other studios, and Skywall got a bunch of different Spanish artists, and, you know, even Erie Publications, they hooked up with the studio in Argentina, and they got a bunch of artists, foreign artists. They were cheap, is the only thing I can think of.
When I think of Spain and Italy and France and England, I don't think cheap. You know, that's the old world to me. It's like
I guess maybe our currency was worth more than theirs at the time.
That's so bizarre.
Yeah, that's the impression. That's what I remembered. That it was financial reasons more so than.
Oh yeah, I guess.
But I mean, they were around from the late 60s to about 73, and then they started, more American artists started. They were still Spanish artists, but then more American artists came over or whatever. I'm pretty sure. I mean, the Filipinos came over because the American artists were going to strike.
Yeah, I remember that.
So, you know, it was financial reasons, but they were technically great artists, and they worked well within the stories.
That book is strong. Is that? Can you still get that book? Is it available?
As a matter of fact, I looked on Amazon. There's a bunch of used copies for a penny.
Are you serious?
Yeah, they're in good condition, they said, but they were a penny. Yeah. I looked on Amazon today. I go, I wonder if this thing is still available. And they had like 9 copies. They're all in good to very good condition, used for a penny. And then the new ones are like $30 and then collector, but you can get it for a penny.
So basically,
plus $3.99.
Yeah, $3.99 shipping. So you get it for
shipping,
$4.
Sure. Yeah, it's worth $4.
Wow.
It's definitely worth $4.
I know what I'm doing when I go home.
When you're doing Amazon purchases, like look it up. Yeah, look at the marketplace. Definitely worth, like, you know, it's worth a penny.
It's worth $30 if you want a nice copy of it.
I think it says on the back of $20. I guess that's what I paid for
it.
Well, it
was in 2005.
In 2005,
yeah. I can't imagine 2005 is 9 years ago.
Yeah, and Ballantine Books, I didn't even know they're still around. I remember Ballantine Books were the guys that published the Frazetta books. So I guess they were still doing them. I don't even know if they're still around
They used to do a lot
anymore.
Of stuff. Didn't they do Ariel?
Yeah,
that
I got it. Oh, that was a great book. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember
the,
that.
The Book of Fantasy, yeah, with that Corbin story and Bruce Jones and all
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it had a Barry Smith, his new work, which I hadn't seen at the time.
Oh, yeah, Ariel. Yeah, it didn't last long, that magazine, but yeah. Yeah, the, you know, when you mentioned Sienkiewicz, I could see some of this looking a little like Sienkiewicz in a way, you know what I mean? Not as abstract and expressionistic, but some of the colors and some of the design work reminded me a little bit of, but it's definitely European looking.
But when Bill Sienkiewicz started painting his comics, he did that on Electro Assassin.
You love that.
I
yeah.
love that. And also, he did that Daredevil graphic novel with Frank Miller. Can't remember the name of it now.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, it was nice. And then he also did Stray Toasters, you know, his own work.
That was weird.
You know, it was weird, but it was really neat.
It was look good, nice to look at.
The devil was in it. You know, the devil went to New York. It was the funniest thing. And it just seemed like a lot of stuff he does. It just seemed like he takes anything he finds out of a junk drawer and a tool drawer and in a garage. Throws it all in a pile and is dragging across the floor. That's what it seems. And all of a sudden you start realizing there's a logic to what he's doing. And I finally got the last, I think I had two issues of it. And I always had it on a list to find. I finally found it through some online seller. And it ties up. It's pretty neat.
Stray Toasters?
Yeah, Stray Toasters. It's a neat story. One, I like Bill Sienkiewicz.
Yeah, I
do. You know, so... But to me, that was kind of the epitome of his work, of what he wanted to do. And then it seemed to me after that, he just disappeared. You know.
He became an inker. He did a lot of inking for Marvel.
Yeah, he still does a lot of illustration. Remember that Jimi Hendrix book, Voodoo Child?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I thought he was completely gone. I know it was years and years ago, before I had met you. I looked him up and said, what ever happened to him? He's doing a lot of movie preliminary work and storyboard work.
He's probably doing commissions, too.
Yeah.
We've always seen him at conventions.
Yeah, illustration work. Well, I got him to sign Voodoo Child. He's not somebody that talks a lot. He's very nice, but he's always matter-of-fact when you get him to sign a book. And I guess, unless you have something to say, and I just told him I was completely unaware of this book. I found out about it, and I love this. This is fantastic. He said, and you were the artist to do this. And after that, he smiled and he was talking about Bob Marley's family. I guess his daughter got a hold of Bill Sienkiewicz asking to do that was a series of portraits or was a book about Bob Marley. But he said the reason I got it is because she liked this book. And he was very very nice, but. I had no idea. If I would have found out about the book, I would have bought it the day it came out.
Yeah,
I
when you
no
showed
idea.
It to me, I'd never...
I told him it was completely under the radar. The book came with a CD of unreleased Jimi Hendrix work, which these days isn't hard to just walk across the floor and fall over unreleased Jimi Hendrix recording these days, which it's coming out all over the place. I still remember in... I think it was the very early 90s, they released Jimi Hendrix Radio 1, and everybody's going on about, you know, new Jimi Hendrix, and this is something.
Yep.
And it's not 9 to the universe, any of that kind of stuff. But after that, they were releasing all kinds of stuff that nobody had ever heard of from his family. And somebody said, how in the world did he record so much of this stuff?
He was recording all the time.
He was. Well, that's
and
why
he
they
was
built,
playing all the time.
That's
too.
Why they built Electric Ladyland Studios.
Yeah, so he could just capture everything he did.
And but they what was he saying? But they came with a CD of unreleased material. And I think at the time that was a biggie. And I got a used copy. The CD wasn't in it. It's okay. I bought it for the artwork. It's fantastic. I love Bill Sienkiewicz.
Yeah, the thing about the Hendrix stuff is, I think I read somewhere. Where they finally did get to the end of the studio, unless somebody has something, but the family think they ran out of, they've run out of studio. There may be some more live stuff they can put out, but I think the studio stuff is pretty much done. Now that I say that, something will come out in the next month or for Christmas or whatever. But the last one I remember was called Neptune Bridge or something like that.
I've never heard of it, but I think I've seen that on Facebook.
I think Mao had it. I remember seeing him, but he might have just had vinyl of it or whatever. But yeah, that was the last one I remember, but put out by the family. But God knows what, you know, what could would still be out there. That's, you know, some jam he had in somebody's, like, you know, studio that, some, hey, I got this.
See,
you know?
I never heard the Neptune you talked about. I've heard of it. But the stuff they release, a lot of them are shows or
yeah,
like
most
you said,
of them are
jams.
Shows.
And that's fine. That's good. But it's not like those three albums he put out, you know. I mean,
well, he was only, like, around in rock and roll for, like, 3 or 4 years before he died. And I put out a lot of... He did a lot, man, you know. Well, I mean, if you want to tie it into a comic book thing, just think of, you know, the artist... That were around. They were around for a longer time, but all the unreleased or, you know, or things you never saw by like Frazetta and all those guys. They did a lot of fanzine work. They did a lot of preliminaries, a lot of movie work. A lot of it's been, you know, compiled. But I've got that. I got that book there. No, it's in the living room. The Frank Frazetta chronology or whatever that talks about all the stuff that he did. It's pretty impressive. I've got the Jeff Jones one there, too, with all the stuff that he did. And, I mean, that's pretty impressive, all the covers that he did and all the fanzines and all the commissions and portfolios and all that. Those guys were pretty prolific, you know?
Yeah.
What's funny was I was looking through the Jones book, and he was doing comic book fanzines in 1965 when he was, like, a kid. And boy, does art get better like 5 or 6 years later. Yeah, it's pretty freaking amazing or whatever, you know. But yeah, I mean, you know, there's a lot of that, you know, there's a lot of artist, you know, stuff laying around that's still to be, you know, tapped and
well,
released.
See, I guess that's something that I think about a lot. I just mentioned Bill Sienkiewicz. A lot of these guys, like Jeff Jones, I remember when Jeff Jones did some comic work.
He did
some DC covers and stuff, and
yeah.
You know, horror titles for DC.
Warren books.
Yeah, and then to me, he vanished. And then I found out about the studio book, you know, that Dragon's Dream put out. And him and Barry Smith, you know, I thought, whatever happened to all these guys? And Bernie Wrightson, to me, was a guy that disappeared after Swamp Thing. And it kind of, it seemed to me like, when I read that thing, it's like they all locked themselves into a wall somewhere, and then all of a sudden, hey, look at all this art. Well, that was never true. They were continually doing it, selling posters.
Yeah.
It just, it wasn't anywhere that I saw it, the areas I looked. And then, it seemed to me like they vanished again. And then Kaluta popped out, you know, in the early 80s with Starstruck, you know what I mean? I see these guys pop up at times. In the early 2000s, I was just thinking of Michael Kaluta, and I looked him up online, thinking, I wonder, whatever happened to him? Shocked to find out how many books he had out, you know, art books and drawing books. And where have I been?
Yeah.
And that's the thing, you know, Bill Sienkiewicz is another one. Come to find out they were still doing work, but it wasn't in areas that I was seeing. So,
no.
It's the internet's a nice thing. It connects you with things, but I'll tell you, you really have to sometimes search things out to find out what's going on.
Well, even back in the 60s and early 70s when they did a cover, you didn't know. You just went to the, you know, you just went to the store, looked at the paperbacks, and it was like, oh, there's a Jones cover. Oh, there's a Frazetta cover. Oh, that looks like I'd buy them for the covers and like read maybe part of the book and then go, eh, it's okay, you know, and put it back or whatever, you know, like all those you know, anthologies that they put out and all the sci-fi and all that stuff. Yeah, if it had a cover plus like some illustrations in the inside, I was like, oh my god, this is like, you know, I hit the jackpot here. Like the that company Donald Wolheim, I think it was DA Dahl Books, I think it was Donald Wolheim. We put them out. They were paperbacks, and they always had, I got some there. They always had, like, that was their name of the company. They always had, you know, Kaluta or Krenkel or anybody like that doing the covers. And a lot of times they would have illustrations inside. Man, when I had illustrations inside, you go, wow, not only did I get a cover, but I get drawings too. That's
yeah,
awesome.
That was rare to me.
And speaking of Krenkel,
oh,
I got this book here.
Why didn't you talk about that one first?
Oh, well, see, the best thing, the best for last, I guess, you know. I've had this book for a while, actually, but it's RGK, The Art of Roy Krenkel. There's a few books on Krenkel, but this is a real nice one. I think Spurlock put this out there.
And his commentary by Al Williamson and Frank Frazetta.
I think David Spurlock put this one out. But the great unsung artist of comic books and illustration, the guy who inspired Frazetta and all these people to do, you know, work or whatever,
said something.
An unbelievable artist. A guy who did the early fanzines, too. I mean,
the first time I'd ever heard of Roy Krenkel was that's the Eternal Savage. I'd seen his work, but I didn't know who he was. I was at, I think it was a Dillard's, a department store in the 70s, early 70s. And they, you know, back then they always had a book section.
Paperback
books.
Yeah.
And it said Edgar Rice Burroughs, the creator of Tarzan. And they'd have the Eternal Savage or, you know, the Moon Men and stuff like that. But Roy Krenkel did the cover painting to the Eternal Savage. And I'm like, wow, the guy with Tarzan did other books? These are awesome. But I didn't know who Krenkel was. And then there was that movie Wizards, that Ralph Bakshi movie. At one point, that wizard, the main character, he got upset about something that happened, and he kind of cursed. And he said three names, and it was Krenkel, Frazetta. I can't remember what the first one was. But I caught Frazetta, but I didn't know what the other ones were. And then this guy I went to high school with, his commercial art class, he was a huge Frazetta fan, and, you know, Jeff Jones fan, Roger Dean. That's basically where I learned of Roger Dean, was through him. But he kept bringing up in Wizards, "Did you see that? Did you see Frazetta?" Well, I caught Frazetta, but I didn't know what the other guys were. And what exactly years was Roy Krenkel doing work?
God, he was doing work in the 50s all the way through the 80s when he passed away.
See, I thought he was gone. I thought he was older than that.
He was older than the other guys, I think.
But see, I thought basically when Frazetta came along, Krenkel was already gone, but they were contemporaries. They were
friends. Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. Krenkel worked for EC. I mean, he didn't do a lot, but he was there. He was like a guy that never really made it big. He was more of an artist, you know what I mean? He would do the paperback covers. I shouldn't say that. He did the paperback covers, a lot of them, or a good chunk of them. But he was never a comic book artist, even though he worked in comic books, but he was buddies with these guys. So they'd all hang out, and they would all talk artwork, and he'd show them, like, you know, books by artists that they may not know of, because I'm sure, like, at some point, you know, Williamson was really into Raymond, and Alex Raymond, and Frazetta might have been really into Hal Foster. Even Frazetta had art training, but he would show them, like, Alan St. John, or Howard Pyle, or other artists. So he was almost like, you know, influencing them, or you know, they all influenced each other, but he was like showing them different artists. So he was a lot. He was more than just an artist. He was like, you know, a historian too. Krenkel, he was great, man.
I tell you, this has got, it even has a write-up by William Stout.
Oh yeah, all those guys. Yeah,
and it has Al Williamson artwork in it. Al Williamson is basically.
They were collaborators on EC stories. Food for Thought was one of them.
It says here, I never knew this, it has a masthead for the Tarzan letter page. Says,
that was in D.C., yeah.
And Krenkel pencil art for D.C. Comics Tarzan letter page masthead.
Yeah. Krenkel actually laid out some of the early creepy covers that Frazetta did. Not all of them, but some of them. He did the layouts for them, and then Frazetta would just draw them and, you know, paint them up or whatever. I think one in particular was the one that, when I was a kid, scared me. I think it was Creepy number 5 or issue 6, where, like, the guy's, like, there's, like, a gargoyle, and he's like, the gargoyle's right on top, almost on top of this guy, ready to, like, kill. And I remember the cut cover scared me. But that was, and I knew it was Frazetta, but I didn't know it was Krenkel's layout, so. You know, and he was really big on cities. That was, like, one of his big, you know, things. He used to draw all these great cities, and you know, people like Williamson would go like, hey, Roy, you draw the cities and I'll draw the figures, you know, and we're all good.
You know, the thing about this, I'm looking at here, some of the stuff is signed 1962.
Yeah.
I was on the world in 62, and you didn't see this kind of artwork. Everything was still stuck in the 50s at the time. This stuff could have been published in the 80s.
And that stuff looks more like it was being, in 1962, that style was more like from the 30s. you know, it was more from the 30s, from like the pulps and stuff like that.
But I mean, it has a modern feel to it. He was ahead of his time. And,
oh, yeah, he was ahead
of his
time.
But they had paintings in here. They got really finished drawings he did. They have some finished drawings that he has a rough inking to, which I really like. It's tribal. And then they have sketches, which I guess were inside story drawings.
The sketches.
And golly, I mean, just.
The sketches are amazing.
You just can't beat this guy.
There was a book, there was a fanzine. Went on for many years. Maybe it's still around now, called AMRA. It was about Burroughs and all that stuff, and he contributed a lot to it, and they're always sketches by Crenshaw.
Well, they've got thumbnails in here. I've seen this cover, The Mastermind of Mars. I didn't know that was Roy Crinkle.
Kaluta did a lot. Did some work for Crinkle. I could see the connection between Crinkle and Kaluta, definitely.
Well, no, Mike Kaluta did talk about Roy Crinkle a lot, that, you know, like Frazetta and Mobius, all he wrote low. But you can see a lot of Michael Kaluta, especially his paintings.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, like I said, Roy Crinkle is somebody that, to me, is a household whole world. That Frazetta completely stole down the movie. I mean, he made it his own thing, but like I said, Roy Crinkle to me is a household name. I know the name. I know his work somewhat. But is this book new?
No, it's a few years old.
Well, I hate to be a jerk, but if I can't find this affordable, I'm going to come back and get yours. I hate to be that way, but
I'm absolutely
getting this.
I think you can find it on Amazon. Oh. I just sold you two books here, you know.
Well,
and I don't get any money off them, but at least I was able to show you some good
books. Well, when my wife gets upset, I'm going to have her come talk to you.
All right. Yeah. That's cool, man. You know, that's a lovely, wonderful book. I know there's a hardcover, but the soft cover is just fine.
Well, the soft cover has those French folds in the
thicker
stock, so the hardcover, I'm sure, would be fantastic, but the soft cover, you're not getting cheated.
I love Crinkle.
Yeah, well, I do too.
I mean, in a lot of ways, you could say Frazetta maybe was the more polished artist, or maybe a more emotional artist, but Crinkle inspired him in a lot of ways,
yeah.
I think.
Well, and I will say this, when I say it, I love Frank Frazetta. I absolutely love Frank Frazetta. But Frank Frazetta, he always had some figures and minimal things behind it. He always had a monster,
you're right.
A naked woman.
You're right.
But I never got tired of seeing him, but basically, the paintings, he had a formula down, and they're always kind of the same. Roy Crinkle, everyone's completely different. I mean, I'm looking at some of these drawings. They got these, you know, like you're in the middle of a city and there's these people sitting around these blankets, all these tools around on people going by horseback. You got cityscapes, you got dinosaurs, but each one, and I could see where Al Williamson was inspired by this guy, Michael Kaluta, Frazetta.
Actually, I'm pretty sure that I have that Wizard of Oz book. I bought that one.
I never knew you did that. Look at that.
And it has illustrations in it, too. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Crinkle actually got Frazetta work for paperback. So Frazetta had been doing Little Abner for a long time.
Yeah.
And he actually helped him out and got him. And I think originally the paperback guy didn't like Frazetta's work, but Crinkle just said, hey, you know, come on, you know, so.
It changed it. Let's see, I'm looking at this one. I see a lot of Bernie Wrightson and Mark Schultz.
Oh, yeah, all those guys.
On this mag, on this,
all those guys came from the same. We're cut from
the
same.
Yeah, well, and all these guys acknowledged Roy Crinkle all the time. They always gave him acknowledgement, always said the inspiration. But nevertheless, it's still, Roy Crinkle was one of those kind of unsung, forgotten people.
He is the unsung hero, yeah.
But it's not that any of these guys hid the fact. But yeah,
he was never a month to month guy. I don't know what the word is, but he was never like clocking it in every month and doing a comic book. He would just do paperbacks and whatever he was into. He was more of a free spirit, I guess is the word.
I kind of see Gray Morrow being influenced by him as well.
Yeah. Morrow's another one, but yeah.
See, the thing is, though, when you're talking about he wasn't always putting the work out like that, I think sometimes that's important. You know, we've talked about
he
rock
wasn't
bands.
A commercial artist, is what I'm trying to say.
When we talk about rock bands or any kind of musicians or artists or cartoonists, I think if you just constantly have that grind, you either develop a style that you can, it's uniquely your own, like Jack Kirby did, where you can just keep putting the work out, it's streamlined, but it's unique. Or you basically just get kind of generic and you're tired of it and you're just putting out the same thing with no inspiration. There's some bands and some artists that'll do work for a while and then kind of disappear and go in another direction. It keeps you fresh. I think with Roy Crinkle,
yeah,
all this work, it's all distinctly different. This is a story he did. He did some comic
pencils.
Work.
Yeah, he did do some comic work. Yeah, not a lot, but he did some, yeah. I don't think he could meet the deadlines, you know. I mean, it's kind of one of those deals where it was like, neither could some of the other guys. I mean, I've heard stories of like Williamson and all them, like, oh, there's a deadline tomorrow, grabbing all his buddies and doing a story in like 2 nights or something.
You know, Mobius is a really fast artist, the French cartoonist, or Mobius, is, I hear. But he, when he did that 2-issue Silver Surfer book for Marvel, which was really nice. And one thing I read about, God, the sketches. I'm ordering this afternoon. but they said that he didn't like the deadline. You know, the comic. You know, there's a 2-issue comic he had to knock out, and he's getting upset at the deadline. I'm thinking Mobius did a massive amount of work. And I've seen him draw online, and it's like watching The Matrix or something. Like, it's not real. There's no way he's doing this. I'm thinking, why would he care about a deadline? The guy could just, you know, blink his eyes and the issue was done. So I can appreciate the fact that some of these artists were having trouble with deadline, like Al Williams and stuff. You're always under the gun, but, man, this is...
Well, they were young guys. So they wanted to mess around and whatever, and they knew they were really good. They knew they were going to get work. They just kind of like weren't, you know, like. But Jack Kirby would be the antithesis of these guys. Jack Kirby would just be sitting in his basement, just cranking out rings. He'd be out messing around, and then we got a job to do. All right, let's go do it. You know, I mean, it's like, it ain't cheap anymore, dude.
Oh, sorry, Al, I'm taking yours.
It's like, it's not cheap anymore. $59 now?
Yeah.
I didn't think it was going to be. I guess it must be out of print.
Yeah,
you know?
It is. Well, I'll
and this is a paperback, too. This isn't even the hardcovers.
Well, you know, that's solar. Whenever the books are out, they raise the price on it.
You may be able to find it. Anyway, yeah, it ain't cheap, but I would still keep looking. For it, but I didn't think it would have gone up that much. I figured it's still in print, but yes.
Yeah, I'm going to get that or find it somewhere. That's nice.
Yep.
I guess I'm going to be ordering this afternoon.
Oh, boy.
But, you know,
Christmas.
It was back when I was in the Navy. I was talking to this guy I knew that was in animation. And he and I were just shooting the breeze, and I was kind of excited. I was playing around and figuring out how to, you know, do things and make things up. You know how it is. And he just listened to him, and then his comment was, I wish I had time just to do that. That's what he talked about. You know, he drew for a living. It was like you said, his work was nose to the grindstone, project to project out. There wasn't time to play around and explore.
This is the opposite.
I mean, that one there, he was figuring things out, designing things. Now, sometimes when you're drawing a lot and constantly working, you kind of develop things on the side, and I know Jack Kirby would basically just design things right on the page, you know, as he went along. Some people can do that, but sometimes you just need some time yourself just to mess around and doodle, you know.
Yeah. I mean, that's when a lot of the best stuff comes out, when you're goofing around, and when you're making mistakes or, you know, doing all that kind of good stuff, but, yeah.
Well, I'm out of breath now. We can't do the show anymore. That's...
Speechless.
Are you going to be upset if I take your copy?
my mom will stop you. She'll run you over with a little car there. You go, I
no,
leave my son's book alone.
No, I would never take a book.
I thought you'd seen this, man. I didn't even realize it. I just popped it out because I was like looking through. He's done other, there's other books on him too that he did back when he was alive, but this is one of the nicer ones. There's got to be a more reasonably priced. We'll look around.
We'll be looking. I'll tell you though, I can't stress to you that the Eleanor Davis book, How to Be Happy, I highly recommend. The Bram Stoker Dracula that Al's brought up is well worth getting. And this Roy Krinkle book, I don't care what anybody else is thinking, I'm finding a copy of it.
All right.
So we talked about some heavy duty stuff today.
This is a heavy duty show. Glad
there you
we
go.
Did it. All right, well, take us out.
All right. Anyway, thanks for listening, everybody. Also, if you don't mind, if you listen to the show and you like it, or even if you listen to the show and you don't like it, why would you be doing that? Please leave us an iTunes review if you are on iTunes. It's a simple thing to do, and it helps us out a lot on the rankings. We're at 7 right now, which I appreciate that, but it would help if we had a few more. Anyway, thanks for listening. In the meantime,
read more comics.
To find Al's other podcasts, Slow Robot A Go-Go, or his blog, Destination Nightmare, as well as Dallas's webcomic, The Mighty Blue, check out the sidebar at our blog, bunchofdorks.com,
and click on the Cyclops!